Welcome to the China Smart State Podcast, a podcast which is all about China's digital revolution and the enormous amounts of social, economic, and political ramifications that that process brings. And today, we're going to talk about money. China, of course, is very well known for having invented paper money all those centuries ago. And according to this new book by our guest of today, it is reinventing money for the digital era. Today, we're talking with Martin Chorzempa. Martin works at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, D.C., focusing very much on China's position in the global economy. And he is the author of the forthcoming book, The Cashless Revolution, China's Reinvention of Money and the End of America's Domination of Finance and Technology. So, Martin, how is China reinventing money? What drives it to do that?
So essentially, when China's large internet companies, Tencent and Alibaba, were starting off, they were missing much of the digital payment tools that we take for granted here in the US and in other advanced economies. So they essentially had to invent their own payment system that would allow their digital businesses to be able to get money from people. One interesting story is Pony Ma, the founder of Tencent, was trying to get money from subscriptions. And the only way he could collect it from people is having them walk into the bank or to the post office to send, you know, a dollar or two for this subscription service, which just was a completely unworkable solution. And that forced them to create something from the ground up that was specifically suited to the digital economy. And has allowed providing a foundation for the super apps that now combine so much of finance and non-financial, you know, products and services in one application, something that's much more expensive and difficult to do with the payment tools available in the US and Europe and elsewhere.
So yes, if you're going to run a business, you don't want to make it too difficult for people to give you money. And it's really interesting that point that you say that because that infrastructure wasn't there, they had to build it themselves. But what is then the difference? You know, here we're obviously very used to PayPal or credit cards. What is the enormous advantage that Alipay or TenPay provide to these companies and the Chinese economy more broadly?
So one of the main advantages is simply cost. It's that if you are a small business in China and you want to accept QR code payments from Alipay or Tencent, you're going to pay something like 0.6, you know, 0.6 or 0.7% of that transaction in fees. In the United States, you're probably going to pay an average of 2 to 3% in fees, which is many multitudes of higher. The other is that if you're one of these small businesses, all you have to do is use your phone to accept these payments almost immediately. Whereas in many countries like the US, you have to sign up for expensive point of sale machines that then end up taking the cards. So China's system has a lot less middlemen in that it's directly providing payment services to you instead of having this issuing bank that gave you the card and then the bank that serves the merchant and then the credit card network in between that then makes things often delayed and expensive.
Yes, and that is obviously for third-party retailers and for the platforms themselves. I mean, here we have PayPal that is owned by eBay for obvious reasons, so you have some integration there. I presume that Alibaba doesn't pay the 0.6% tax, which is already a lot lower than the credit card tax, as you said. How does it change business models for these large platform companies themselves?
Well, that's a really good point. They're able to move in what's called a closed-loop system within their ecosystem, say from an Alipay wallet to an Alipay wallet or a WeChat Pay wallet to a WeChat Pay wallet. Those are free, frictionless, and immediate. So if you control this payment system and you have something like a super app, which provides all these different services in one application, you can seamlessly move the money and the data together at the same time. So a lot of what people get excited about with, say, the cryptocurrency community and Web3 and things where you have these like smart contracts where the code moves money and all these things, that can actually, a lot of it, not the decentralized part, but a lot of that can be done seamlessly in these platforms because of how easy it is to move money. So if you want to sign up, let's say you're a company providing bike rentals in China, all you have to do is integrate with a small program, say a mini program in Alipay or WeChat Pay, and you have access to a billion potential users. And you can not only access those users, but you don't have to ask them for their payment details in the way that in the US you have to ask somebody for their credit card number. Because Ali already has it and it's already integrated into the platform. It makes onboarding a new service super easy.
Yes, even when you're a beggar in Beijing, I remember, obviously I haven't been to China for quite some time because of very obvious reasons, but I do remember my last visit before, once upon a time, if you were a Westerner in China, you were pretty much an ATM on legs. And now, obviously, as a non-Chinese resident, you couldn't use Alipay. I tried to pay with hard cash in a Beijing restaurant and people were pretty much looking at me as, oh, ye traveler from the Stone Age. What are these little notes with mouse face on it? But the same thing is true for beggars. I mean, you see beggars with their Alipay and their TenPay QR code. You've been mentioning data, and obviously one phrase that foreign China watchers are very trigger happy to use is this idea of China's data hungry tech giants. So it's one thing to have sort of the data that you need for the payment in order for that payment to be completed. But more broadly, can these companies derive value from the information that they have, and how have they been trying to do that?
They can derive an immense amount of value to it. So one of the most important things that they've achieved is digitizing payments. So when I moved to China in 2013, it was all cash-based payments, 100%. It was actually quite difficult to find somewhere that would accept even my Chinese debit card, which I used pretty much only to get cash. But of course, an analog transaction like that doesn't generate any data trail. So you're not able to use that commercial data for anything. And then instead, these platforms suddenly are generating, immense quantities of data from payments. And that allows you to do a lot of things. If you're the government and you have access to this data, you're able to get a real-time look at how economic activity is being directed and how well the economy of a given area is going based on whether payments are going up or down, something you wouldn't see with cash. Specifically for these platforms, the free movement of data and money among them created really cool opportunities for them in finance. So if you think about a small business, for example, it's notoriously hard around the world to lend to a small business because they don't have many assets. So they can't put up, their property as a security for the loan because they don't have property.
And in China, you obviously didn't have that data trail that would tell you how much that small business might be bringing in.
Exactly. But now if they're selling on Alibaba, you, as the controller of the payment system, can see exactly how much revenue they're getting, exactly how much they're paying their suppliers, whether that's shifting in some way, and you can create a real-time risk engine, which allows you at very low risk to lend to these businesses that banks can't figure out how to do, because you have this real-time information on their flows in and out. And that allows you as a lender to control risk quite well. And then of course, all this payment data also tells you where people are buying things. So from a marketing perspective, figuring out who to push coupons to and who to market goods to, it actually reduces the costs a lot. I mean, a lot of this discussion is framed negatively around these issues today about targeted advertising being surveillance. But a lot of this actually makes it cheaper for businesses to find consumers who are actually likely to want what they're selling and more cheaply reach them compared to just sending out, something like an advertisement in the newspaper.
Yes, although now with these lending business, we start ending up in trouble. And obviously in 2019, China outlaws P2P lending, which is sort of one of the novel applications of that. What went wrong there?
Essentially, it's very difficult with any innovation to really tell ex ante when it's really blowing up how successful it's going to be in the long term. There are a lot of examples like pets.com that don't go very well. The problem with financial innovation is that the fallout from failed financial innovations tends to be much more costly than non-financial innovations. If pets.com goes down, then, or the equivalent goes down, then the venture capitalists and angel investors who already have a lot of money, who knew that they were doing a risky investment in some startup company, they lose the money. The employees who knew that they were joining a risky startup lose their jobs. It's unfortunate, but that's kind of how things go. If a bank fails, or if a financial institution that people have entrusted their money to at large scale fails, you have major earthquake in the financial system that can create social stability problems. You know, the one of the largest P2P platforms that failed, Izubao, had 900,000 investors who had given it $7.6 billion US dollars. And in this case, the P2P problem was that most of these guys were just running underground banks. And they put up this facade saying, we're just a tech company. We only match people who want to borrow and people who want to lend. We don't actually do any of this stuff ourselves. We're just connecting people with data. And we have these great AI-based risk engines with the, you know, big data coming in, and that's giving us an idea of who the good credit risks are. But all this was a facade. They were running risky underground banks, and it took the government a lot of effort to realize this and shut it down. And they did so too late after it was already far too large.
Yes, and then you get the reports about suicides. And, you know, part of the problem is, as we're now seeing with the crypto crash, is indeed when financial innovation goes wrong, someone ends up holding that bag. And then you see also around the same time that Beijing starts moving against these credit rating pilots that the People's Bank of China had permitted, but then ended up not licensing. Perhaps best known, obviously, Sesame Credit for, you know, a whole lot of the social credit system myth building around it. Why did that not go ahead? What, because, you know, if, as you say, these platform companies, because they have integrated data, they don't just see the payment, but they also see what they're buying, where they're buying, all this information about consumers and vendors. Surely they should be in a good place to issue these credit scores. What drives the People's Bank of China then to go no?
So this is one of the most clear manifestations of something we're seeing pervasively in the Chinese government's view of the platform economy, which is conflict of interest and market power. So in this case, the aggressive moves that Alipay did to market Sesame Credit really unnerved the regulators, because you can make a good argument that Alibaba data can predict if somebody's going to pay back a small consumer loan. But they also made it possible for people to get visas to foreign countries and to get expedited security screening at Beijing airport if you had a high enough score. And I don't think there's a clear justification for that based on the data. They began to really worry that the scores were reflecting not a true neutral evaluation of credit risk, but someone's an evaluation of someone's use of the platform. And in a sense, there's nothing nefarious about this. If Alibaba doesn't have any data on you because you don't use their services, they're not going to be able to give you a score. Or if they give you a score, it's going to be low because they don't have much confidence in it. But this, the PBOC began to worry that this would just incentivize people to become more heavy users of the big platforms already, and that they might try to give better scores to people who create more revenue for them. And that if they're providing credit themselves and scores that other people use, then they're kind of providing a critical service to banks that they compete with. And so they really began to be concerned about this and pulled back in something that initially had a lot of promise. And I think that was really a canary in the coal mine for the way that that they view now much of the financial system and fintech.
Now, absolutely. It's almost like they went, you can have a credit rating system or you can have a loyalty scheme, but you cannot have both at the same time or the one masquerading as the other. And you're already sort of casting forward to it in the canary of the coal mine. But obviously, you know, since 2020, the Chinese government has essentially gone into the platform sector in general, both feet forward. And the first shot heard around the world, as it was the fact that the IPO of Ant Group was cancelled after some would say Jack Ma gives a particular speech at a financial forum in Shanghai, where he accuses traditional banks of having a pawn shop mentality and pretty much intimating that he could do a far better job if only these pesky regulators let him. But also after draft regulations come out that severely limit what happened or what could happen in these financial services that were making Ant Group, as it was renamed, a lot of money. Could you just talk us a little bit through that sort of that cascade of events that ends up with essentially what would have been the largest IPO in the world simply not taking place.
Sure. So the way I think about that event is as a dam breaking. And what I mean by that is there are two forms of pressure that are building up to a much higher level of regulation of fintech than had existed previously. One is the emphasis on financial risk and financial security that Xi Jinping had made a key priority, you know, taking over even economic meetings that are usually chaired by the premier to really show that this was a critical priority. And that cut down on a lot of shadow banking and risky activities. Naturally, fintech had a lot of risk and a lot of hidden risk involved. So that began to create more regulation and more pressure for even further regulation. The other is the global backlash against big tech companies. So you had the criticism of 996 work culture, the treatment of delivery workers, concern about monopoly. You know, these companies were no longer the David facing down the big state-owned Goliaths. They were the Goliaths themselves, and a lot of the popular support that had given them a degree of political protection was eroding significantly. But the dam that I referred to that these two forces were pushing up against was the political influence of Jack Ma and Pony Ma, and generally the tech sector, which was viewed quite rightly, I think, as furthering a lot of China's key objectives by digitizing commerce and improving innovation and growth and all of these things. But when Jack Ma gives his speech, what he does is make this really obvious, this political support, and appear to be actually a political threat to the regime. Because he's not only criticizing regulators, he explicitly rejects the idea that there's systemic financial risk in China, which is something that Wang Qishan, China's vice president, and the one who ran the anti-corruption campaign for Xi Jinping, had said was the key concern in fintech space earlier that day at the exact same conference. And so Jack Ma was not just criticizing the government, he was directly contradicting one of Xi Jinping's right-hand men and pushing against one of Xi's key campaign priorities. And it was viewed as one of the quotes from Chinese officials that really struck me is right after they saw this speech was, "Hai shi ke yi guan de," which is, he's weak now. He's made a huge mistake politically. And that shot up these concerns about the company that had been brewing for a long time all the way up to the Politburo level and to Xi Jinping himself. And I think you can draw a direct line from that speech to the cancellation of the IPO, which begins with anonymous criticism by PBOC officials and then gradually more and more bold criticism of the company, and then culminates really with the Politburo statement of preventing the disorderly expansion of capital. And then that creates a new political direction. The dam has broken and the pressure now is free to flow into all these anti-monopoly and data security and, you know, personal information protection and other restrictions on this space.
Yes, you already mentioned the disorderly expansion of capital. What do Chinese senior officials mean when they talk about the disorderly expansion of capital? Is this just about the platform economy, or is this like a broader view of China's economic future in the quote-unquote new era?
So this is one of those examples where, you know, the top level provides some sort of slogan without that much content. And then it's up to the lower level regulators to actually figure out what that means and what about it is disorderly, where does the order need to be imposed, and what needs to be prevented. And in this case, one of them is definitely entrepreneurs who are interfering with regulatory processes and using their influence and lobbying to water down regulations, say, on financial risk. That's a crucial one. The other is abusing positions of market power to improve their business at the expense of competition and smaller firms. And those are probably the two main spaces that I see the disorderly expansion of capital being manifest. But the authorities are really constantly trying to navigate exactly what this is, because if you follow what the Politburo and other government organs say about it, they say that overall the platform economy is going in a positive direction and it's healthy. There are just a few problems. And that's a signal, I think, to the regulators to say, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We're not trying to kill the platform economy. We really like it. We just need to fix some elements of it that are we view as a threat.
Yeah, and I'm sometimes wondering more broadly, also when you look at the 14th five-year plan and the new growth direction there, you know, there are subordinate plans for the digital economy. And they seem to be sort of indicating a move, you know, towards deep tech, towards, you know, call it a sort of 21st century of German style manufacturing driven economic modernization, as opposed to the finance driven economic model that we have in the Anglo-Saxon world. Would you say that that's also a component of it, that that essentially what China is saying is we want there to be a financial sector, but it should never be more than playing a supporting role in firing up the real economy, because frankly, over-financialization leads to volatility. And if you're the Communist Party of China, volatility is exactly the thing you do not want.
Yes, absolutely. So when the government provides its objectives in this space, almost always the first one is support and serve the real economy. They don't want things like cryptocurrency speculation. That has always been a red line. They've cracked down upon that almost immediately every single time. And in this case, related to fintech, the part that they've criticized is these consumption loans, where the idea is you're getting people to buy things that they can't afford. Whereas usefully, your consumer credit allows you to buy something like a refrigerator that you're going to enjoy for 10 years now, rather than saving up for 5 years and then buying that refrigerator or a car or something like that. But their view is that if you're using it to buy things that you ultimately can't afford, you're not creating sustainable economic growth. And their criticism of Alibaba and of these other companies is that they want to create credit so that they can make more sales, and that the revenue that they're gaining is not going into fundamental deep innovations that will allow the government to achieve its new objectives, which is a lot of the low-hanging fruit of digitization that these companies created has already been reaped. And now what they're really concerned about is security, especially not relying on US technology. And these big tech companies are not really seen as helping that. Instead, they're viewed as, I think, as Dan Wong has memorably put it, you know, trying to shave a minute off of your latte delivery in your office by creating an algorithm that squeezes the delivery driver a little more. That's really not where they see fundamentally useful innovation occurring.
Yeah, and you already mentioned it. We have to talk about crypto. Obviously, China was the biggest Bitcoin mining country in the world. Now, cryptocurrency has been completely banned. How did that all go? How did that play out?
So Bitcoin really begins to take off in China around 2013 and is one of the first areas of crackdown related to financial technology. A bunch of regulators get together only a few months after it began to boom and made it very clear, no financial institutions should touch this. It's too risky. It's also not going to be a parallel currency, so you better not start selling things that are invoiced in Bitcoin. And that caused a crash in the global Bitcoin price. Obviously, it's now back up to much later. So every time that something has become quite popular in China, this occurred again with initial coin offerings around 2017, they start to worry a lot about speculation and ban it. Mining is really interesting and is a bit different in that Chinese companies really begin to lead from a technological perspective in mining equipment. They're able to create machines that can do cryptocurrency mining much more efficiently than other firms. And there's a quite convincing story to be told about how it benefits regions like Inner Mongolia that have a lot of power that is not necessarily able to be channeled to the high occupancy areas. They have a lot of wasted power, which could be put into cryptocurrency mining. And some of that might be like hydropower that could be put in. But I think the reason that they decided to go against it is that, you know, if you're mining cryptocurrency, you're getting cryptocurrency in exchange. And that allows you to have a source of crypto that you can then, you know, use to help facilitate capital flight and buy off the officials at the power stations so that you're getting free electricity and doing all sorts of corrupt deals. And just generally, cryptocurrency is seen as eroding the monetary sovereignty and general sovereignty of the state. So anything that facilitates that, even if it benefits these poor areas that really don't have any other economic engine, can't be tolerated.
Well, yeah, you could argue that, if you adopt the Chinese state's perspective, what would you want to use Bitcoin for that you cannot do in yuan? And the answer is almost automatically things that you want not to be traced, which automatically or nearly automatically means illicit transactions. It would be the same like saying, hey, in Inner Mongolia, let's say you've got a great climate for growing heroin, which can obviously be very profitable, but that doesn't mean it's a good idea.
Yes. The flip side to that is that some of this, you could argue, is useful in the sense that the government wants to trace all these transactions. They try to stop people, except the most connected, really, from getting their capital out of China, even if it's, say, to have their kids study abroad. So in some sense, something that weakens China's capital controls isn't from a, if you're looking at the purely the Chinese government's perspective, you think that's bad. But allowing circumvention of those controls is in a sense like allowing VPNs in China. And that can allow illicit activity to occur, but it can also allow legitimate activity from our perspective that the Chinese government doesn't want. So think about donations to human rights lawyers and these kinds of things that you couldn't really do in the traditional financial system. And of course, there's both the illegal stuff, which is bad, and then there's pure speculation, trying to invest in what you think is going to go to the moon. And that's something that probably all we would agree is not necessarily useful.
No, but China obviously hasn't wanted to throw this baby out with the bathwater either. And we see that they've been going sort of two interesting directions, where on the one hand, they've used the blockchain technology, not so much for the coins itself, but for some reason or other, China sees blockchain as underlying technology for a whole range of new infrastructures and online services. And on the other hand, they've taken the coin idea, but without the blockchain, and they're sort of building the electronic yuan, the ECNY. Is that another way in which China is both reinventing money and reinventing contracting, or is this hyped and way overblown, and should we be paying far less attention to it than we do?
I'm on the second camp, which is that we should be paying a lot less attention to it, because really, I don't see yet the fundamental innovative elements of the ECNY that are going to remake the world economy or, compete with the dollar. For a lot of reasons. In part, we just don't know exactly how it's going to be designed. And a lot of what makes a currency competitive are things like the rule of law and openness and predictability and existing network effects, which provide a lot of strength to the US dollar. Of course, China will gain, I think, even without an ECNY because of just how much it trades and invests with the world. But that's less of a technological issue than a kind of a governance issue. And then on generally how it approaches blockchain, and I think this applies to the ECNY too, the way I think about blockchain technology is that it allows for a greater degree of decentralization in the organization of economic activity or the storage and transfer of value. But decentralization flies in the face of everything that China is trying to do right now. So I see most of the applications that people get really excited about blockchain in China. And I say, you could do that with a database. It's not really decentralized. You're just using the word blockchain because it allows you to get access to government funding and government support and attract engineers that are really excited about this new thing. When if you say, hey, we're working on a database, you're not gonna get the MIT engineers to come work for you. So I generally tend to be a skeptic of this space, but especially in China, because the whole ethos of what China is trying to achieve is really contrary to the new possibilities that this affords.
And China obviously faces its own constraints. We were talking about the internationalization of the ECNY, and people sometimes get fairly apocalyptic about this, where the ECNY is going to become the means of payment in sub-Saharan Africa or the global south when China takes over. And then, of course, there's the harsh reality that for the Chinese government. I mean, the dollar is a global currency because the government in Washington at some point decided to allow its control over the money supply to be lost. And I'm not quite sure that the political economy applying to the Chinese Communist Party would allow the similar handover of economic sovereignty or monetary sovereignty, I should say, to the market. So as long as the Chinese government wishes to have very tight capital account controls, the ECNY cannot internationalize. Or am I saying things wrong?
I think that's quite right. And what I've seen is even some of the most staunch advocates of capital account liberalization in the past, or at least those who said, well, at a time when China is no longer facing outflow pressures, that's when you should open the capital account. And now they're saying there is no ideal time to open the capital account, because if you do it when things are stable, then if there's a moment like now, if China had an open capital account now, it would have a lot of struggles because the US interest rates are now higher. So a lot of investors that are previously were investing in renminbi are now would love to pull that money right out and invest in the US to get a better interest rate. And that would be a real challenge to authorities. So every time in this international currency space, they've had the chance to provide openness that would allow them to play a greater international role, they have always chosen the domestic stability instead and a desire to maintain those controls. And I don't see that changing at all with the ECNY, because having an international currency, like you say, with the US is a responsibility. It's not a free lunch. You lose a lot of control that makes other things difficult.
Yeah. We're coming to the end of our time, Martin. It's been tremendously interesting. But as a last question, there's this thing we always do. We call it the road less traveled. We very often find that people who research China in general, but certainly in technology, run up against a wall of myths, misconceptions, things that people get wrong, or things that people simply aren't taking seriously enough or looking at with enough attention. What is that in your field? If you had one thing to say that really you go, people aren't talking about this and they should, what would it be?
I think that it is the idea that financial technology is some general purpose thing. And if the Chinese come up with the perfect technology for the ECNY, then they're going to rule the world. And, you know, kind of like people a few years ago were saying Alipay or WeChat Pay are going to rule the world because they have this new model. Actually, what we find is this space is really nationally specific and has a huge amount of geopolitical implications that constrain what countries can do. So I think one of the most interesting things I've found in the book is that despite having immense amount of capital, great technological systems and innovations and database technology and cheap ways to get payments set up, all this experience, they really haven't been able to internationalize Alipay or WeChat Pay in a way that goes after consumers in other countries. I think that has important implications for us not needing to freak out about the ECNY, that these are really heavily context-specific innovations, which were really useful in China, but require a lot of complex adaptation and maybe can't even be done by a Chinese firm because of geopolitics in other countries.
And that's really interesting, just to conclude, because, you know, one could have this hunch where you say, good, these Chinese tech companies, they've grown up in an environment, like you said, where that pre-existing infrastructure, including payment infrastructure, simply wasn't there. So they all had to build their own stuff. They know how to deal with capricious governments. They know how to deal with a client base with, shall we say, relatively low levels of disposable incomes. You could think or that means that these Chinese companies have a skill set that should put them in a position to go into other countries at similar levels of development and repeat. And yet, if I understand you correctly, that's not happening. So what's stopping that?
In one sense, it's that what made them so successful in China is that these companies, Ali and Tencent, already had a large user base in their country. And then they could simply say all the QQ, you know, hundreds of millions of QQ users or, you know, people who are already buying things on Taobao were able to use this new system. So they kind of took an existing network and added payments to it and symbiotically grew. And when they go abroad, what they're finding is that, you know, they don't have these users. They don't have the kind of existing scale that they needed to get off the ground. It's a bit of a chicken and egg problem in payments. You have to have people accepting it and people wanting to use it. And if they don't have that existing user base, they don't have that advantage. And that's been one of the key bits.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. There is much more that we could talk about, Martin, and much of it is in your new book, which I recommend that everyone take a look at, The Cashless Revolution, China's Reinvention of Money and the End of America's Domination of Finance and Technology, out soon and available in all good bookshops. Can I pay for it with Bitcoin?
Find a bookshop that'll accept it, then maybe.
Thank you so much, Martin. This was another episode of the China Smart State podcast organized by the Leiden Asia Center. I was Roger Kramers. See you next time. Thank you.